Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, December 14th, 2013. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. We're in a moment of history in which the human race may be doomed due to the lack of qualified leadership in governing institutions. This has been the focus of numerous discussions from Lyndon LaRouche, from his wife Helga LaRouche, and it's been borne out day to day by the headlines in which we see the absolute stupidity and immorality displayed by most leaders and would-be leaders around the world. In the U.S., we have the disaster, which is Barack Obama, an immoral puppet of murderous oligarchs whose regime continues to remain in office only due to the corruption and cowardice of the Democratic Party elected officials and the stupidity and selfish greed of the Republicans. We might also add to that the degeneration in the ability to think of most of the population. But on November 22nd, and in the weeks leading up to that date, we had an opportunity to hearken back to a different time when we actually had a real leader in the White House, President John F. Kennedy. Our efforts and articles published in the EIR, videos in LaRouche Pack, and public statements culminated in a memorial concert held in Virginia, sponsored by the Schiller Institute, to commemorate the 50th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination. But in presenting a very unique performance of Mozart's sublime Requiem Mass in D minor, which was preceded by some poignant comments from Mrs. LaRouche, who's the founder of the Schiller Institute, and others, and interspersed within some clips of significant speeches by President Kennedy himself, we brought back to life the idea that we as a nation were once better, and that we must discover that higher quality of human creativity, of compassion, and of a mission for the future, again, now, if we are to have a future. Joining me to discuss that event and its strategic significance are two leading participants who were very much among those making the performance possible and making the performance a success. Renee Segerson, who's a cellist and has been very involved in music work with the Schiller Institute, in addition to her day job as a leading fundraiser for the LaRouche organization, and also John Segerson, who conducted the performance and is well known for his work over the years in fighting for an improvement in classical culture, actually a restoration of classical culture in this country. So Renee and John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Harley.
Hello.
Renee, why don't we start with you? I'd like to get your thoughts about the significance of this event now that you've had a couple of weeks to think about it.
Okay. Well, first of all, because we've succeeded in getting a worthwhile DVD replica of the event, which we can stand behind, there continues to be a radiating effect of enabling people to listen to the sequence of the entire thing, which started with the political speeches going into the music, and to experience the accomplishment. To borrow a word from Lyndon LaRouche, the event established a new standard for musical performance, for musical activity or musical practice in our entire political movement. And it's a new standard which we really want to supersede. We want to get to even the next higher level. And what that means, it's not just that we had the wonderful opportunity in a beautiful environment to deliver the Requiem Mass with the help of some very accomplished instrumental performers from the Washington area. Actually, some people who rank among the absolutely best brass and woodwind players that the country has, which was really very gratifying for all of us. It wasn't just that kind of accomplishment, but that there was an intersection of things going on in the build-up to the performance and in the performance, which in totality really made it a kind of usefully shocking event. It really was kind of shocking, to be blunt. People should remember that, considering it was held on November 22nd, a day that every American who's over, who was at least 4 years old, the day that Kennedy was murdered, that every American will say, I knew where I was standing. I knew where what I was doing when I heard the news that the president had been that the president was assassinated, the president was shot. Besides the fact that that day has an incredible emotional significance for people throughout the nation, remember that this particular November 22nd also occurred right after the whole government had shut down. And we did this in Northern Virginia, in Vienna, Virginia, which is part of the old Washington Beltway, where hundreds of thousands of people were very directly, very personally affected by the government shutdown. It affected the whole country. The country was actually in a panic during that period of time, to be blunt. But these people were affected on the most immediate day-to-day basis. So it really was an elevating occasion that has had tremendous significance for those there. We're getting it out, and the way I would just summarize it, I mean, I've assembled some of the reactions. I can go through that later, but just to summarize it preliminarily, it really created a much stronger foothold for us to be able to communicate to the people we're in touch with throughout the nation what it means to bring together classical music, classical art, with the fight for statecraft, with the fight for science, economics to be brought together, that classical art is an indispensable component of the sustained activity of making this part of your daily life, so that it is part of the way you think about science, government, and the future. That the event gave us a much stronger foothold to be able to bring this as a reality into people's lives. And that's why I think it was shocking for the people who went through it, and it's a wonderful thing to share with people subsequently. So that's how I would summarize it preliminarily.
Okay. And John, the obvious choice of Mozart's Requiem, I think it's important to note that people who did follow some of the events around the 50th anniversary, there were often mention of Kennedy's involvement in the arts, his wife's involvement, Pablo Casals coming to the White House. But in choosing the Requiem, what was the thinking behind that, and how did that function? And then I'd like you to give us a little sample of what was done at the concert. So why don't you take it from there?
Well, in January of 1964, just a bare month and a half after Kennedy was assassinated, there was a very important concert that was held in Boston, it was not just a concert, it was a Requiem Mass for Kennedy, held at the largest cathedral in Boston, which had an assembled chorus of 300 and a huge orchestra. And they did a performance of the Requiem along with a celebration of the Mass with the Cardinal, who was there at the time, Cardinal Cushing. This was an incredibly emotional event there. And we knew about that. I've known about that for a long time. And when we were thinking about a performance of the Mozart Requiem, we also recalled our first performance of the Requiem, which was back in 1984, because at that time we did it as a dedication to the another assassinated great leader, Indira Gandhi. 1985. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And because a performance of the Requiem should never be just for nobody in particular. To get the right emotional and the right tone of any performance, you always has to be dedicated this is for the performers and for the audience itself. It has to be dedicated to a real person and a real person's accomplishments and a real person's legacy. And so when we were thinking about what we wanted to do on November 22nd, we said, well, we have to do something. We can't just sit there and do nothing. And indeed, as some of the people who came to the concert heard about it, and precisely in that way, they read about it in the paper because they were sitting around saying, we can't just sit here and do nothing. We've got to do something. Ah, finally, there's a concert here of the Mozart Requiem, and they came. And it's that tension which creates the magic, which you might call a magic, but it's really not magic at all, of the effect of the Requiem. And as Renee was saying, the other intention of it was to weave in not just a tribute to what Kennedy was, but Kennedy's vision of the future, which has still been unrealized, and which was so oriented towards cultural progress and also very, so strongly scientific progress, so that the message of the concert, we knew, had to be very clear that cultural and scientific progress go hand in hand. There's no way of getting of having something separate. And music itself, classical music itself, loses its meaning, loses its any real sense of impact if it's divorced from this idea, this intention of scientific progress. So that's,
and John, let me just note on that the Requiem was also performed at the scientific pitch, the tuning that existed at Mozart's time, the so-called Verdi pitch, but was unique in that sense, that it was true to the initial ideas of what Mozart heard and what he wanted the audience to hear.
Yes, and I wanted to get into that to demonstrate that, because for some people it's a little bit hard to grasp. So a little bit later on, after I play the opening, I'd actually like to go and do a little comparison so that people can hear the difference in the tuning,
sure,
which is not just a difference in the sound, but it's an overall difference in the emotion and the thoughts that go behind the emotion in it. So why don't I play this is the opening of the Requiem. I'm going to play two parts. This is of our performance, and I will do the opening section, which is called the introitus, or the introduction. And then later, what I will do is also play a part with soloists, which is called the tuba mirum, which is about the trumpet. And rather than saying a lot about it, I just want to read you the words to it so that you are following what the chorus is saying in the first one. Let me read the Latin of the very beginning. It's Requiem aeternam dona eis Domine, et lux perpetuam luce ad eis, which in English is, grant them eternal rest, O Lord, and let light perpetual shine upon them. And then it goes on after that with a soloist who sings to a very old chant, which goes way back into church history. The words, a hymn befits thee, O God in Zion, and to thee shall be paid a vow in Jerusalem. Hear my prayer, to thee all flesh shall come. And then it repeats the Requiem aeternam. And then followed that is a very spirited and fascinating fugue in the tradition of J.S. Bach, whom Mozart studied very intensively, and who had an incredible impact on really all music to follow. I'm not going to play, I'll play just the very opening of the Kyrie, just so you get an idea. Here we go. Thank you. Okay, well, I'd love to be able to play more of it, but you can find this on our Schiller Institute website. You can
download Renee also it, so. Mentioned that it. Renee mentioned the DVD is available. Renee, how do people get that if
they
like go
on the Schiller Institute website, either through the link from the LaRouche Pack page or through newparadigm.schillerinstitute. And down at the bottom of the page, there's a bunch of options on how you can download it yourself or order it. And everybody should order it, and we'll mail it to you.
Yeah, and there, or if you have the... If you know how to do it, you have equipment, you can burn your own DVD right there. You can download the file to do that from.
Now, John, obviously, I mean, this is a very dramatic opening statement, Mozart. And, of course, you're conducting. You can't see the audience, and Renee is concentrating on her notes, so she wasn't really watching. But I know we picked up afterwards. Renee, you were telling me last night that there were a number of responses that we got that indicated that it really did have a powerful effect on the audience. And you know, maybe you can relate a little bit of that before we go to the second excerpt.
Well, there was a tremendous tension in the room, right, even before the music started. It's worth it to take note of that because, you know, for 750 people from the Washington Beltway to show up at an event sponsored by the organization founded by the wife of Lyndon LaRouche is itself a complete stab in the eye against our political enemies. So this has to be kept in mind. And many of the people who were there knew that on some level. I mean, and there was a certain kind of tension in the room when people came in, which got dissipated when the greeting from the president of Ireland was read. There were gasps all over the room, and people got intrigued and calmed down because obviously something was going on that really was very appealing. And then we played this, Helga spoke, she was greeted with tremendous respect. And then you know, Neil Gallagher had, former Congressman Cornelius Gallagher sent this beautiful greeting tape. So John didn't even look at the audience when he stood up. You know, usually when a conductor gets up in front of an orchestra and there's a room full of people, the conductor turns around and bows to the orchestra and they applaud. He had it arranged that the second that Gallagher's tape was over, he just stood with his back to the audience looking at the orchestra. So that there was something that was communicated to people, which is what you're hearing being said and what's about to happen in the music are really one subject. They are not separate. And this really grabbed people. I mean, it was very obvious that this really grabbed people. And then halfway through the Requiem, after the Lacrimosa, when the Requiem poem ends, we played these tapes of John Kennedy speaking. And then John did the same thing. He just stood up quickly and started the Domine Jesu for the last section of the Requiem. And when it was all over, he did not move. I mean, he did not whip around to the audience. He just stood there for a moment of respectful silence. And when he finally turned around, the audience just knew they had been through something. Everybody in the room could tell. And with single-minded purpose, they all stood up and started applauding. And it also showed in some people, when they left the church, they were crying. Other people just left at the opportunity to meet Lyndon and Helga LaRouche. I mean, there was a reception. The church was fabulously hospitable. These are really very, very kindly people. And people just leapt at the opportunity to meet Lynn and Helga LaRouche. I mean, there was tremendous excitement about the fact that they were there. And there was a hospitable kind of common, there was a conviviality of people talking about what they thought about it. And some of the people in the church said, your voices will ring here forever. This church has existed since 1984. Across the board, everybody said, this is the most beautiful performance that has ever been conducted here. There's nothing to compare to it. And it is a known location in the Washington area for concerts. It's not like it's...
John, why don't you introduce the second excerpt, and then we can get into more on what it is people are hearing. And also, I think there are a number of other issues that have come up in the discussion so far. But let's hear the second excerpt.
Good.
Why don't you introduce it?
Sure. This is a section there. There's where, unfortunately, we can't play the Dies Irae, which is where the wrath of God is coming in. It's very, you may be familiar with it, but we want to do the section right after that, which is which starts out "Tuba mirum spargens sonum" with the bass singing. Tuba might remind you of the word, of the English word of a tuba. And indeed, it's not in Latin, it means a trumpet rather than just a tuba. And the words go, "The trumpet's wondrous call sounding abroad in tombs throughout the world shall drive everybody forward to the throne. Death," and then the tenor sings, "Death and nature shall stand amazed when creation rises again to answer to its judge." This, of course, is the day of judgment we're talking about here. And he, the tenor, goes on, "A written book will be brought forth in which everything is contained, from which the world shall be judged." And then the alto chimes in, "So when the judge is seated, whatever sin is hidden will be made known. Nothing sinful shall go unpunished." And the soprano then asks a question, "What shall I then, wretch, say at that time? What advocate or lawyer shall I entreat to plead for me, when scarcely the righteous shall be safe from damnation?" And then all four ask that question together. The trumpet is played by the trombone in this case. You'll hear it.
Oh,
John, what is really striking listening to that after you told us what we were listening to, the words, is that this is a living drama that Mozart composed. It's not some dirge or sorrowful notes of remembrance, but it's actually a call to action, isn't it?
Absolutely. In many performances, it's misthought of as a dirge, and Mozart's intention is not clear. If you might bear with me, I'd just like to play an example of a way that the very opening is played as a dirge, and then you'll
sure.
hear the difference. I'm not going to say who it is. But it's a professional recording done quite some time ago.
Okay.
I'm just going to play the very opening of it. You'll get the idea. This is the opening of the Kyrie. Actually, let me play it, and then I'll play the, just for comparison, play the opening of ours to get the idea.
Okay.
Whoops. Oh. Excuse me. Wrong one. As you can hear, it really is done as a dirge. Now,
hearing that makes you want to jump into the grave.
Yes, exactly. Now, just to compare, just in case you missed it, here's us doing it. Again, just the very beginning.
That is a very striking difference. Let me just remind our listeners, you're listening to The LaRouche Show. This is December 14th, 2013, and our topic today is the historic concert that was given in commemoration of President John F. Kennedy that was given on November 22nd by the Schiller Institute, and we're talking with two of the people who were responsible for pulling that together, John and Renee Segerson. Now, John, did you want to say more on this aspect of the dramatic nature of the living dramatic nature of the
I just
Mozart
wanted to point out the genius of Mozart on this, because just to go back to the first two lines of the Requiem, Requiem aeternam donaeis Domine, give them eternal rest, O Lord. But then the second line says, et lux perpetuum luceat eis, but then let light perpetual shine on them, which seems to, there's a tension there of the contradiction that, you know, people are, that everybody is supposed to be in an eternal rest, but then the light is shining, but it's perpetual light. And so this immediately gives I mean, this was a stroke of genius by the poet who originally thought of this requiem centuries ago. But Mozart had, in a stroke of genius, was able to get that contrast, because the opening, I don't want to do it again, but just to sing it, it's Requiem Aeternam. It's very, it's a little bit dirge-like, but it's very, it goes up and down. And then when he opens up at Lux Perpetua, the whole orchestra changes, and the chorus starts saying, Et Lux Perpetua, like that. And this like wakes everything up. And that constant tension between those two aspects of the very opening creates a tension all the way through the work, which no composer before that of the Requiem, and many people composed Requiems in the centuries before Mozart did, and many have done it afterwards. But I think Mozart was able to capture that in a way that no one else has. The other thing that I just wanted to point out at this point, you may have noticed, is the difference when I played the last two examples, was the difference in the tuning. That is, the first example, the slow one that I played, was at a higher tuning, whereas ours was at the lower natural tuning of A432. But just to point that out, I wanted to play two other example, very short examples, just so you can hear the difference between the tuning. This is another orchestra, and this is a different part of the Requiem. But you'll hear, just so you can compare. This is the higher tuning. Just to there, and now ours, at the natural tuning. I hope you could hear the difference. But this difference in tuning is something which the Schiller Institute has been fighting for over 30 years. And one thing that makes me very happy about this concert is it was really the first time we were able to demonstrate this principle of the natural tuning with a full symphony orchestra played on modern instruments.
John, I'd like you to explain to people what you mean by natural tuning, because this is something that we've lived with and fought for and have a history of for over, as you say, 30 years, but for many people it's not something that they would know about. So what is the natural tuning? And then I have a question for Renee.
Well, this came out of our studies in the 1980s of the work of Johannes Kepler, and the ordering of the planets and the ordering of the solar system, around the idea that there has to be a reason for everything. There's a reason why the planetary orbits are the way they are. It's not just arbitrary. It didn't just happen that way because of pairwise interaction of millions of different particles or something like that. There's an ordering principle involved. And along with the discussions that on the ordering of the planets, we especially with Lyndon LaRouche himself making this breakthrough, he pointed out that music is the same way, that nothing really should be arbitrary in music, and that there's an ordering principle here as well. And the way that you can find that ordering principle is in the way that the human voice, which is the instrument, which is the mother of all musical instruments, is ordered itself, because the human voice has registers. It is not just from the lowest note to the highest note. It's not just a simple smooth going up. Anybody who has tried to sing upwards knows there's certain breaks in the voice. Depending on level of training, they can be very ugly breaks, or they can be very, very, very nice breaks. And the same thing with instruments that were developed during Bach's and Mozart's time. They also had these breaks, and these were used as a way of creating counterpoint. And again, that gets back to this idea of the contrast, because music without contradiction and contrast and paradox is really not worth very much. It's just, it may be very sincere and so forth, but it's really not anything that's interesting. And so we began a campaign to get the tuning low, and we enlisted the support of just about every great, truly great singer of that in the latter part of the 20th century, and who helped signed a petition demanding that this be done. Carla Bergonzi, Renata Tebaldi, Pavarotti, Piero Cappuccilli, the names go on and on of the people who supported this effort. And we gave many demonstration concerts, but mostly with either solo instruments or solo voices. But this was the first time we were able to demonstrate this with the full modern symphony orchestra.
Well, let me then ask Renee, because you were playing the cello in this.
Right.
For the most part, for the most part, instrumentalists don't think about this question of tuning, but since it was such an integral part of the performance, what was the discussion among the people who were not part of the Schiller Institute, but who were recruited to the effort?
It varied. We intersected, in terms of the winds and the brass, a grouping of people who, by and large, are around the U.S. Army band. And they're used to doing all kinds of unpredictable things, depending on the circumstances, including, by the way, one of the trumpet players who has played taps at Arlington Cemetery for decades. He's recently retired from doing that. But, you know, these are the kinds of people who were around us. So they took it as a challenge. They were intrigued. And they actually practiced a lot before we came together. If you have a really good ear, you can actually hear them calibrating while they're playing. It's actually quite beautiful. You know, somehow the idea that in a performance, everything's got to be clean cut, like you've just been to the tailor and every little thread hanging out has been cut before you go before, you know, the crowd, is a sort of a funny idea about music. One of the interesting things about live performances is sometimes it's the funny little things that the musician has to act to change right in front of your eyes, which actually makes it more intelligible to you what's going on. You actually hear these people fighting to get the intonation if you listen to it more than once. And we were very gratified by that. We were actually very excited. So these are very talented people. The string players were more skeptical. They just were kind of like, they were, but when they heard the chorus, and it's not because, and it's funny because the other guys had to work at it. They didn't have to work at it. They just had to tune, you know, sort of adjust their tuners. They were sort of saying, why do we have to do this? Why do we have to do this? But then when they heard the chorus, and knowing it was an amateur chorus, but also hearing the dialogue effect, there were actually people who afterwards said, this is beginning to make sense to me. The string bass player said, went home after the rehearsal and spent the night with his son on the internet, reading everything they could find on the internet about tuning, and came back the next day and said, I think this is really interesting. I'm really interested in what you're doing. So it was a discovery for them. It was actually a discovery. And while there was a certain amount, there's always a certain amount of professional wiggling and hemming and hawing when we talk to people about this. When you have a situation where 1 week before the concert, the New York City Opera was shut down because they went bankrupt, right? Which actually happened. People are much more interested in finding out what might actually inspire a revival of classical art in this country. And when they realize we've done our homework, that we're not being a cavalier about this, that we're doing this for a reason, most people, after a little bit of hemming and hawing, say, well, let me find out. I have to find out for myself. And when they did, they were actually, you know, quite... they said, okay, you know, most of, just about all of them said, this is extremely interesting. I want to keep thinking about it. So
well,
that was really.
Let me take this then back to this other question then, which is present clearly in the Mozart conception of the Requiem, but also is clear in the presidency of John Kennedy, and also not so much in Kennedy himself, but in Lyndon LaRouche's discussion of what Kennedy represents, that this idea of a future orientation, the idea also, I think one of the most beautiful speeches he ever gave was his American University speech on June 10, 1963, which was an appeal to the Russian people to join with the United States to break out of the Cold War. And it came as a result of a discussion that Kennedy had with one of his interlocutors, with the Soviet President Khrushchev, who said to Kennedy, when Kennedy said, how do we get a breakthrough here? And he said, speak to the Russian people. And Kennedy's famous words where he said, I think we played this at the concert, where he said that we breathe the same air, we have the same aspirations for our children, we are all mortal. And this idea in Kennedy of having to be in a hurry because of the recognition of his mortality, and that connected to the idea of the future. John, I'd just like you to reflect on that for a moment, because I know this is something that you've thought about over the years in looking at great classical culture.
Yeah, I don't think that particular one was played at the event, but I mean, the one that most affected me was Kennedy's speech where he talked about the future of nuclear energy, and he said that by the turn of 2000, that we should be mostly nuclear energy that the United States should be mostly nuclear energy based economy. And I think this really affected everybody in the audience, because it gives you an idea of how little we have accomplished, how far we have slipped from that kind of optimism that Kennedy represented. And I think what I'd like to do, if there's time, Harley, is to play the final remark that we did play, which is the one at the groundbreaking for the Robert Frost Library at Amherst.
Oh, absolutely. That's beautiful.
At Amherst,
it does get right at this question of the relationship between art, culture, and politics in the future.
This was at the founding of the Robert Frost Library at Amherst College in Amherst, Massachusetts, and it's dedicated to the function of art and implicitly great classical art in society. So let me play that.
When power leads man towards arrogance, poetry reminds him of his limitations. When power narrows the areas of man's concern, poetry reminds him of the richness and diversity of his existence. When power corrupts, poetry cleanses. For art establishes the basic human truth, which must serve as the touchstone of our judgment. The artist, however faithful to his personal vision of reality, becomes the last champion of the individual mind and sensibility against an intrusive society and an officious state. The great artist is thus a solitary figure. He has, as Frost said, a lover's quarrel with the world. In pursuing his perceptions of reality, he must often sail against the currents of his time. This is not a popular role. If sometimes our great artists have been the most critical of our society, it is because their sensitivity and their concern for justice, which must motivate any true artist, makes him aware that our nation falls short of its highest potential. I see little of more importance to the future of our country and our civilization than full recognition of the place of the artist. The highest duty of the writer, the composer, the artist, is to remain true to himself and to let the chips fall where they may. In serving his vision of the truth, the artist best serves his nation. And the nation which disdains the mission of art invites the fate of having nothing to look backward to with pride and nothing to look forward to with hope.
I would just add to that that the nation also that says that art has nothing to do with the search for justice is also a nation which is headed down the drain. And unfortunately, that's what most art, or what is promoted as art today, it fails on that very account.
Well, I think there's been an association of art and celebrity today, that the so-called artists are also celebrities and are vying for popular opinion. And what Kennedy makes clear there in reflecting on what Robert Frost said, it actually reflects what Schiller said, which is that the artist himself must work to perfect himself so that he's then able to make these kinds of judgments. And it's really quite, you get a sense of how far we've fallen, that Lyndon LaRouche has mentioned that it was the assassination of John Kennedy that started us on our downward tumble. And you look at the absolutely fraudulent character of our current president, if you weren't actively involved in fighting to change it, you'd be stuck in a tragedy with no hope of the future. Now, Renee, I know you're using the concert and the event as a springboard to get people more involved, not just in contributing or doing things, but actually to think about themselves differently. How do you approach that in the organizing?
Well, we've mainly been getting this out. I just want to say one thing in terms of what you were just saying before to add to that. Whenever we do anything serious in this work with Lynn, we're super conscious of the fact that we are in struggle against and are out to really completely eliminate as a scourge the influence over classical music of what was done right after World War II, which was done coming out of World War II by the crowd around the Congress for Cultural Freedom. I think it's really worth mentioning that at this time, because a lot of, we've had an opportunity to speak to some very top musicians in the recent period about this entire effort. And it's very sad to find out what they said to us, which is, when I do a concert, and these are very accomplished people, when I do a concert, I just hope that there's one person in the audience who for a few minutes is happy while I perform. And this is a reflection not of anything that has to do with what the real subject of the music is about. Because what we did in this concert is we transformed people. We did the kind of thing that Schiller challenges us to do. This concert, they walked out of that building different, and the people who are listening to it are being changed, sometimes in a way they don't even understand. And this idea that somehow music has no concept of value inherent to why the music is written is an evil indoctrination that comes from Alan Dulles' and others' involvement in this post-war hoax called the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which really started a witch hunt against musicians who were dedicated to using music to eliminate the causes of the World War I, World War II, who were to demonize these people as all being Nazi collaborators or whatever else they could nail them on. And music has not recovered from this, as Lynn has often emphasized, that Furtwängler's last concerts were a swan song to great composition, and we really see ourselves as reversing that. And I think this, as I said, this event was a major step in that direction. And in terms of what you're saying, many of the people who were not there but have been listening to the recording have actually reported. I think of the niece of one of our members. One of our members mailed the DVD to his niece, who's in her 30s, is not one of the political hotheads in the family. And she sent him an email, which she never does, and she says, I can't stop playing that DVD. I just keep listening to it over and over and over again. And I thought this was really extremely interesting. And you know, that night, the night of the concert, some people went to catch something to eat at IHOP. When they walked in, there were five college girls here in Leesburg sitting around a table at IHOP, madly sending messages on their cell phones to their friends about how they had just been at this explosive concert in Vienna, which was about Kennedy and Mozart. And they were sitting there just going on and on about how it was so fantastic. We've affected people in ways that they can barely even articulate and describe. And I think that that radiating effect will continue. We even penetrated this onto Capitol Hill, where we've been giving out the DVD to some political contacts throughout Capitol Hill. I have to admit the reaction was very, very funny. These are people who usually see us out on the street, you know, with our very tough posters and are familiar with the poster of Obama with the mustache. And one of the most common comments, Harlot, you're going to laugh when you hear this, one of the most common comments was, I can't believe that the LaRouche people are so nice as to have done this, which I thought was really cute. But the point is, there's a radiating effect, and we are drawing upon that radiating effect in order to make people more receptive to the mission at hand. You know, it's one of these metaphorical, non-tangible kinds of things, which, as Lynn always points out, is the real core of how you change people. Because what people are really reacting to is the interplay between the great Mozart, who was the most fervent optimist the world could possibly imagine, and a universal genius in a dialogue with Kennedy, and you're participating in it. And this is the kind of thing that it very clearly changes people and makes them more receptive to seeing themselves as human, as opposed to victims of this terrible situation that we find ourselves in.
Yeah, and that's the only way that we're going to be able to revive the what classical music truly represents, as opposed to the mere performance of classical music, which of course in many cities there's lots of it, and you can even get it piped into all this stuff piped into your internet, you know, streaming and so forth. But it's not just performances of classical pieces that's going to make a classical renaissance. It's precisely this intention, this morality, and this seeking for justice, as John Kennedy said, that will make it. Harley, are you there? I think we lost him.
Are you still connected?
His phone didn't go out.
Are you still, the phone is still connected. Well, that was a pretty good segue. I mean, we could end it where you ended your mm-hmm. commentary there. I've been doing this for 555 times now, and this has had a bigger effect on me than any we've done so far.
Okay,
George. Well, I suppose that's a very good way of ending, and we'll thank Harley once we get back in touch with him.
Why don't you call? Can you call him back?
I will.
Thanks.
Okay.
Okay. Well, this is we'll sign off until next week.